I'm going to bring the Government Accountability and Information Technology of the House to order for Tuesday, March 20th, 2007. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2542. Representative Crummell, thank you for being here. I appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Representative Jerry Crummell, House District 26, which is Wilsonville, Sherwood, and over to Gaston in Washington County. And, Mr. Chair, my thanks to you for accommodating me in terms of hearing the bill now and everything. I really greatly appreciate it. I'm sure, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm sure you've all seen the news reports about, a youth counselor at the local rec center being brought up on sex abuse charges. That unfortunately happened in Hillsboro, and unfortunately it happens way too often. We're seeing it more and more in the news these days. I think House Bill 2542 is a good way to reduce the number of those headlines, and it's really a very simple bill. And this was brought to us by a volunteer coordinator at a church in my district. My constituent noticed a couple of years ago that the cost to do background checks on volunteers moved up from $30 to $70. And in 2005, the state fee went from $12 to $52, and the federal fee is still at $18. So that's how it made that jump from $30 to $70. This church usually has more than 100 volunteers, and they help out helping out every year. And you know, I guess like the commercial says, I could say, well, so do the math, and you can see that $7,000 just for that church to screen their volunteers is a huge amount of money. And many churches and other nonprofits are now being required to do these background checks by their insurance companies, or they face very high liability insurance premiums. So 2542 is simply to waive the fees to nonprofit organizations that provide tutoring or mentoring services, and also grant a 25% discount on fees for the background checks for organizations that provide programs for youths and seniors. The cost of the federal background check is already reduced by 25% for these groups. So instead of it being $24, the fee is $18. And I'd like to see us do the same thing for the state fee. If we reduce or waive the state clearinghouse background check fee for these organizations from $52 to $39, it would ease the financial hardship on the groups that already have a tough time making ends meet. And these groups simply can't exist without their volunteers. It would also encourage them to screen more of their volunteers, thereby increasing the public safety, and a 25% decrease or $13 discount, then the total cost would be $57 instead of $70. There is currently a waiver process offered by the Oregon State Police, and I'm going to get these numbers potentially wrong, and so I'm going to rely on the staff from the Oregon State Police to bail me out on this, and so she'll be able to do that. And it's Patricia Whitfield, from the Oregon State Police. And but we understand that there are about 1,509 individuals that had their fees waived between July of 2005 and July of 2006. There were another 1,864 that had to pay the full $70 fee in that same area, or in that same time frame. And they, I think as the ones that, the 1,864, I think are the ones that don't mentor, that had to, so like I said, Patricia will bail me out here. She's been very helpful with this. We also checked with MCSL on what other states are doing, and we got a list from 2001, and at that time there were 10 states which giving discounts for their background checks, and Washington was one of those states. I realize that there's a fiscal impact to the agency for this bill, but I would argue that if we can screen out even one volunteer who's had a checkered past, and prevent that person from harming one little kid or one senior, then this bill will have been well worth the price. If we think about the cost of that one case, we have to arrest the offender, We have to prosecute them. We have to incarcerate them. We have to incarcerate them while they're being prosecuted. And then the untold cost is that of the victim. And you can't put a money amount on the victim. When somebody has been victimized by somebody else in a personal crime like this, it is abhorrent, and it is something that stays with the victim for the rest of their lives. It stays with their family, and it's something that no one should have to go through. And, Mr. Chair, with that, I'll conclude, and I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much. Any questions from the committee? Doesn't appear we have any questions for you at all.
Mr. Chair.
Wait a minute. I have one. Representative Byer.
Thank you. In, I guess it's line on the first page, line 9 and 10, I guess that's, there are two pages, where it says mentoring programs or tutoring programs. Is there any way that this could refer to schools, school districts? Could that possibly get brought into this bill, or was that your intent, if it is possible that that might happen?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Byer, thank you for the question. Currently, school districts, for as far as their paid staff is concerned, teachers, administrators, and everyone else, is to gain a license from TSPC. They are required to have a background check, and it is the full check. As far as the volunteers in the school districts, I don't know if in the current language if they would be covered or not. They're nonprofit. I don't know if they and they're obviously providing mentoring services. So you're thinking like the smart reader that goes out, or some of the other volunteers that go out into the schools and help out in the classroom, or tutoring and mentoring kids and that sort of thing.
After school programs and.
I mean, we could certainly make the bill do that. Although, that would be something that we could certainly add in. Would be the school district, if it were the opinion of legislative council that that school districts wouldn't be covered under this or aren't covered under another part of the statute.
Follow up.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And it wasn't so much that I was asking to have them put in. It's just that if by some chance they bring them in, the fiscal becomes a bigger. Fiscal than I would think that you might have anticipated.
Yes, it would make for a bigger fiscal. Mr. Chair and Representative Byers. Yes, it would make for a bigger fiscal than I think anybody anticipated. I think the other thing is that if the school district has, for example, with the smart readers, that I believe that they're actually covered under like a 501c3 organization already. So that organization would be able to qualify under this bill. So there may be cases where the school districts would already be able to take advantage of this bill.
Thank you.
Does that make sense?
And to follow up on that, most of the school volunteers are supervised. During their volunteer work, and so probably would not need this bill for those folks. Unsupervised, we need it.
Absolutely.
So.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Any other? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'll let you know how much the fine is later.
I thought I was getting a little exit music there.
I'm going to ask the two other witnesses to come forward at the same time, Patricia Whitfield and Kathleen Joy. And Patricia, if you just identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. For the record, Patricia Whitfield, Oregon State Police Identification Services Section. Our section is the portion of state police that does perform the background checks. And I don't have a prepared testimony, and I'm trying to make some notes, maybe follow up on some of the questions. Definitely there will be an impact to our operation. We just don't know what that impact will be because we don't know how many nonprofit organizations really are out there, how many volunteers. We would assume that there would be more checks performed. We just don't know. To answer the question regarding school districts, 181533, which is the process for clearinghouse, and defines the organization, mentions that the organization is not governed by state regulatory licensing agencies. So I was thinking that the school districts, which do their background checks through the Department of Education or Teacher Standards and Practices, wouldn't necessarily qualify as clearinghouse. The interesting thing about the clearinghouse process, it's different than anything else we do, is the agency has to qualify to show us that they're a 501c, and if it's a volunteer and they're asking for that waived fee, we qualify them that way. They are not authorized to receive the criminal history information themselves to do the fitness determination because that information is confidential. So the statute instructs that state police will make that fitness determination for those agencies based on the criteria they provide us. So it's quite labor-intensive, and that's part of the reason why that cost went up so much. In 2005, our section was instructed that we need to be self-sufficient with our support, with our fees. There wouldn't be general funds, and so at that time we did do a change for all of our fees, and our fees incorporate the cost of doing the business, cost of providing that service, plus the core services to create and maintain those criminal histories, which is, of course, important to be able to provide those results. So that's some of the complexity as far as the cost. And, of course, any reduction in that would be some sort of an impact to us, whether we need to reduce our staffing to still meet the cost of providing service or perhaps ask for general fund to supplement that like we do for the wage fees. Representative Kremel's numbers were correct for what we had provided. There were 1,509 qualified volunteers that we waived the fee. We are required to waive both the Oregon and the FBI fee, but we are obligated to pay the FBI fee, so we must continue to do that. There were 1,864 volunteers that didn't qualify for the waived fee that actually paid that $52. With that, I think I'll close and see if you have any other questions. I'd be happy to answer for you.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, on the background checks, are they all the same? When OSP does a background check on somebody or for an agency or for a volunteer, are they kind of at different levels of in-depthness, or are they all, are they the same?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, that's a good question. I will try to answer it. The clearinghouse process, as I explained, is different than a state agency check. That an agency has been authorized to conduct background checks, such as school districts. They are authorized to receive a criminal history. We perform the fingerprint check and provide them the results, and they make the fitness determination, and it's done. The clearinghouse process, we perform the fingerprint check after they've been qualified that they do meet to be able to do that check. We gather their criteria and apply the results of that background check, whether it's the state criminal history or nationwide criminal history. We apply the charges there to the criteria that they've provided us and give them a yes or no answer whether they meet that criteria. So there is a difference in the types of background checks. There's one other program that, if I read this correctly, is impacted. What we call open record, anyone can do a name-based check on another person in Oregon. It is an Oregon-only check, and it is name-based. But we would anticipate that some of those checks that we do might also be volunteers. There isn't a mechanism right now that they have to tell us that it's a volunteer or what it's for. But that's a name check, and again, the record is provided by statute to the requesting party. It's convictions and arrests within the last year only. We have to screen out any arrests that don't have a disposition that are beyond 1 year. So that's a different type of background check that often comes up. Okay. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. It's kind of interesting. I just would hope that we wouldn't get a false sense of security just because somebody's got a background check, because sometimes they're just Oregon only. Maybe they're from South Carolina and had problems. That's what I was kind of wondering.
Wait, sounds like this is not an Oregon only check that we're talking about. Is that correct?
Right. The clearinghouse, the statutes that are referred to in this bill do provide for both a state and nationwide check, and it's typical that they don't ask for Oregon only.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for background information, how many people end up not qualifying? You do... Out of every 1,000 background checks, 200 people, two people. I'm almost afraid to ask the question because, the one that I'm just curious, the one that, slips through, might be.
Correct. Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, I do not know the answer to that. I don't have that number. I could certainly make note and get that back to you.
Please follow up.
Okay. Thank you. My next question was, what exactly does this background check look at? I understand it's a state and a federal type of a background check. And how does that differ from, say, a private employer using a private vendor to do a background check for employment purposes? What are the differences between those two different types of systems?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, the background check, fingerprint background check that state police conducts is searching the repositories for the different states. My office is the central repository for Oregon, and there are the same throughout the nation. Those agencies submit criminal arrests to the FBI to create a national database. When the Oregon check is done, it is based on fingerprints run against our database, which is all arrests that are submitted to Oregon State Police. Statute currently provides all felonies and sex and drug misdemeanors are required to be submitted to us. We will take anything that gets sent to us because we know that there are many misdemeanors that preclude folks from purchasing firearms or other things. So we will not limit it to that, but it's checking the fingerprint based criminal history files for Oregon, and the same on the national level. If a private employer who has does not have the authority through some sort of statute to do a background check, the option they have is through the open records process that I explained, Oregon Statute 181560, I believe, name-based check. The law requires that we screen out any information that can't be released by law, so they would get any record of convictions we have on file and any record of arrests within the last year. I am also aware that there are private companies that are in the business to go state by state and purchase what records they can and compile what they might say is a nationwide check. And I believe that they've let it be known that it's not necessarily constitutes, it's not the same as a nationwide check based on fingerprints. They have what information they can gather from states. So the difference would be just the data that they actually have access to, which is typically very limited. You have to have either the governor's executive order or a statute giving you the authority to access the full criminal history.
Thank you very much. Ms. Joy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kathleen Joy, for the record, the Executive Director of Oregon Volunteers, the Commission for Voluntary Action and Service, which is located organizationally inside Housing and Community Services. I'm speaking today on behalf of the members of the Commission and the State Committee on Volunteerism in support of the continuing policy discussion regarding volunteer screening in the state, and we believe this discussion is enhanced by Representative Crummell's introduction of HB 2542. The State Committee on Volunteerism met on March 6th and spent an extended period of time discussing the relationship between this bill and SB 61, the Oregon Volunteer Screening Act, which we discussed with you during a public hearing on February 27th and that you're going to do a work session on later today. During our previous testimony, we talked about the criminal background check as only one component of a comprehensive volunteer screening policy. It's our desire to ensure that organizations have a clear understanding of the levels of risk associated with various volunteer positions and that they develop a policy appropriate to those risk levels. It's our belief that a state police-administered fingerprint background check is not necessary, as the chair alluded to earlier, for every volunteer working with children, the elderly, or other vulnerable populations. However, in the instances when an organization's policy determines a need for fingerprint background check, we recognize that the associated costs are a deterrent both to those organizations whose policies require them to pay for the check and to the many volunteer organizations that require the potential volunteer to pay all costs associated with a criminal background check. And that's something that happens quite frequently in the state. It's not directly addressed in this bill, but it would be something that would be of some interest if the bill's to move forward. We applaud the intent behind this bill, while at the same time recognize the potential implementation problems associated with an increase in the number of screenings conducted by the state police. I believe of those 1,800 background checks that Patricia alluded to earlier, that probably as many as half of them might be by organizations that might qualify for this, and that the number will grow exponentially as other organizations become aware of this reduction in price. The background check unit is small in size at the State Police Department, and we have worked a lot over the last several years with the organizations that are covered under the Clearinghouse Bill, which we consider to be the Cadillac to which all agencies should aspire. We project that there would probably need to be some staffing increase to keep up with potential demand, and we do that based not on any numbers that we've been able to come up with at this point, but based on the surveys and conversation that we had with people in the past, and it was why we didn't actually ask for a reduction or free volunteer checks when we started writing SB 61 this year, because we think there's a certain level of information gathering that could be done as part of our education policy package that might help us get a better number on where people actually want to go with that. We want to request that if you're considering moving this bill forward, that you consider an amendment based on the discussions of the State Committee on Volunteerism about the legislation. We want you to consider adding the clause, "The request is made by an organization that provides services to youth, the elderly, or other dependent persons." In the rest of the bill, other dependent persons are included as a category that is excluded somehow from this line about the reductions. And other dependent persons are those people with physical and mental disabilities who fall between that age of 18 and 65, who are just as vulnerable as anybody else. So we would advocate for making certain that those other dependent people had the same opportunity. We're very interested in this proposal. We recognize its positive value to the vast number of organizations that are committed to serving vulnerable populations. We think this is a complicated issue because it's so difficult to understand what the numbers might look like. On behalf of the volunteer community, we want to thank Representative Crummells and Cameron for their willingness to bring this discussion to the attention of the legislature. We're pledged to working with them on strengthening access to volunteer screening information for all organizations in the state, and look forward to the day when this or similar legislation is put into statute. Thank you.
I have a question myself. It sounds to me as though you believe based on your discussions, that there will actually have to be a staffing level increase in the department?
I'm projecting that leaving schools outside of this, from the people we talk to, there are vast numbers of people who are not doing a fingerprint background check right now because they don't have the resources to do that. I believe they are in addition to these 1,862 people who clearly would, many of them would love to have a relief in the amount of money that they're paying. We know that there are a number of agencies right now that are doing a name-only check because they can't afford to do more. I believe that as we start to implement our education program around the state, that more people are going to become aware of their own liability and their own risks that's going to raise it up. I can't promise you that there's going to be an increased need for staff, but I do know that based on the timeliness of some of the reports right now, if you add that exponentially and you're encouraging people not to have to allow a volunteer to volunteer until the background check is completed, that you leave a disparity, a big discrepancy between the time of application and the time that the volunteer actually is able to serve.
Any other questions?
Yes.
Patricia, what's your guess of how many more background checks would cause you to have to increase your staff?
Mr. Chair, I would have to get back to you on that. I don't know the number. I do know that we have our fees are based on the number of staff to fall within our goal is to have a turnaround of 8 to 10 days to respond back to agencies. And our staffing levels definitely have an impact on that. We also know that if we see an increase in volume, if the revenue is there, then we would request to also increase our staffing level. But as far as a number, finite number, I would have to get back to you on that.
Okay. Representative Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Probably more of a comment than a question, and that is, this is a great goal. I have concerns, not just on the numbers out there, but just on how we're going to be able to do it, and the fact that we have not put adequate funding into the state police at this time, and I don't see how we can keep adding more things on top of their workload without coming up with additional funding while we do it. So that would really influence my decision on a bill like this, is how the budget process goes.
Seeing no other questions, thank you both very much for being here. Seeing no one else signed up for this bill, is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify? If not, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2542, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 61. Yes, would you please do a...
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 61, we heard this bill, as Kathleen mentioned, on February 27th. It's a bill that directs the Oregon Volunteers Commission for Volunteer Action and Service to adopt recommended best practices for screening volunteers. At that meeting, there was discussion among the committee members about the potential for the creation of a liability for organizations that did not follow those best practices once they are adopted by the commission. And in response to that, the Housing and Community Services Department staff worked on developing some amendments, and those are before you in the form of the Dash 1 amendments. I believe John Fletcher is here from the department and could speak to those. If the committee would so desire.
Yes. Would you please, Mr. Fletcher?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, John Fletcher with Oregon Housing Community Services Department. And Patrick has summarized things pretty clearly. We heard the committee's request that this be very clear, that when Oregon Volunteers goes out and checks with other states and finds out their best practices, that that doesn't come back and somehow create an expectation that volunteer organizations would have to comply with those best practices, or that there would be an obligation, or even worse, that there would be somehow in any contested case something that would create a standard where someone would be liable for not following those best practices. We talked to our general counsel about the best way of possibly eliminating this concern, and the language before you is the result of that conversation. So I'm happy to answer any questions.
No questions. Thank you very much. I would accept a motion on this amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 61.
Representative Byers moved that we adopt the -1 amendments on Senate Bill 61. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 61 as amended to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Byer has moved that we pass this bill, Senate Bill 61, to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Aye.
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 Aye. Having received the unanimous vote of the committee, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move that we place this on the consent calendar. I don't agree.
So,
okay. I withdraw my motion.
Okay. Would anyone like to volunteer to carry this bill?
Last time I heard that, Mr. Chair, I had to carry the bill.
Would you like to carry this bill?
I'm happy to. It's not that I objected to the bill. I just thought that since it didn't come out of the Senate with a clear, slam dunk, that it would be important to tell the House members what the differences are.
Okay,
and I'm
this?
Fine with carrying it, yeah.
So Representative Thatcher will carry the bill. Okay, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 61, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2702. Representative Edwards.
Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2702.
Representative Edwards moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2702. The motion is not debatable. Is there any objection to the motion? If not, the rules are suspended. Representative Edwards.
Mr. Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2702 was sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation and referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Edwards moves to reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2702 was sent to the floor with a due pass amended recommendation and referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? If there's no, seeing none, is there any objection to the motion? Motion carries. And the measure is once again before the committee. Representative Edwards.
Mr. Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2702-1 amendments dated March 9th were adopted.
Representative Edwards moves to reconsider the vote by which the committee adopted the House Bill 2702-1 amendments dated March 9th. Is there any discussion? Committee, what we're attempting to do here, if there is no objection, is to remove the -1 amendments so that we can add at your pleasure, the dash two amendments, so that we can move this in a subsequent session to the floor without going to Ways and Means, because this will, we hope, remove the fiscal on this bill.
I have a question about the dash twos.
Okay, well, right now we're talking about removing the dash one. Does this pertain to that?
Yeah.
Okay.
The question is, because you're trying to change it with the dash twos, the dash twos declares an emergency. Now, why are we declaring an emergency when we haven't done that before?
Would you like... we're going to...
Wait until after we've dealt with the dash ones and then have that discussion if that's okay.
I don't think it is okay. I think that
either way you want to do it.
I think we need to do that now because the representative wants an answer now.
I want to answer it before I reject this one.
I understand. That makes perfect sense. Mr. Allen, would you come up and see if you can answer that question for us?
Thanks, Chair Riley, members of the committee. Pat Allen with the Office of Regulatory Streamlining. Do you want me to stick to just that narrow question, or
please for this moment?
You
can stick around at the
certainly the reason for the emergency clause is the dash twos provide for periodic reporting to the legislature, and the first report to ensure that any action that comes out of this is timely is scheduled for November, which would be before the effective date of the bills that don't have an emergency clause. And I can point you to where that report requirement is if you're interested. It's at the top of page 2 of the dash 2. Mm-hmm. Excuse me, I'm sorry. It's it's line 20 of page 1.
Where is it in the dash 1s?
It's not in the dash 1s.
It's not in the dash 1s because it didn't require...
Chair Riley, members, the dash ones didn't require actually any reporting back to the legislature of what was going on. That's a part of what's new in the dash twos, and it's just simply the timing of the reporting back. If you require something that happens before January 1st, following session, then you have to have an emergency clause to do that.
Somehow it takes away the requirement to run it through Ways and Means?
We believe that it does. And fiscal will, after we've heard the testimony on the dash 2 amendment, fiscal will take that into consideration and make a new determination.
I'll go with taking away the dash 1s, but okay. I'm not saying I'm voting for the dash 2s.
Okay. Any further discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to the motion? Okay, the motion carries. And the measure is again before the committee in its original form. Right. Mr. Allen, would you now discuss the Dash 2 amendments for us and give us a rundown on why we're doing this and what it does?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, for the record, Pat Allen with the Office of Regulatory Streamlining. You'll recall in the original hearing on this, there was discussion of fiscal impact. And at that time, in dealing with that, we were really focusing on the part of the bill that talked about going back on existing documents and revising them to be in compliance with plain language. And I think I testified to the fact that we were pretty comfortable that because you were able to prioritize and set out a schedule for doing that, you could spread that out over whatever time your resources would allow you to do that. I would say we didn't. What it turned out was generating the fiscal impact was not so much that part of the bill as the fact that as of January 1st, following session, everything new had to comply with the new plain language standard. And particularly for large agencies, that even just considering new documents, newly revised web pages, newly revised form letters, things like that, could in fact end up having dealt with thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of individual documents. And it was a legal standard that had to be complied with. And the concern, particularly for large agencies, is to make sure they were complying with that standard, that they didn't feel that was work that you could reasonably assign to somebody that, you know, to sort of do in their spare time while they're doing other things, that it would actually take staffing to make sure they were following the law. What the Dash 2s do gets us to, we think, at least certainly for the next biennium, to the same place we all want to get, which is more documents and more communications that are plain language. What it does is it requires the governor to assign an agency responsibility for developing a plan to go do this, identifying some things that they need to report back on, and then providing reporting dates so that what can be done is to do that work in a way that it can meet the resources available at agencies. So, for example, and I'm speaking from the perspective of it's most likely that either Department of Administrative Services or my office, Regulatory Streamlining, would be the agency designated, and certainly we'd do this work in partnership, so we've talked through some of this. There are a number of agencies, Department of Environmental Quality, Employment Department, Department of Consumer and Business Services, that are really interested in diving into this work in some significant ways right now. And in fact, we'd already been in some discussions about how to go about doing that. And so meeting those agencies where they are now, identifying resources, training, establishing any kind of standards that they need, those are things that could all be done right now in the existing scheme of work that we're all doing. Taking those training and resources then and making them available to other agencies would be another logical step that could be done within those resources. Identifying research projects, if you will, kind of along the lines of what you heard from Washington, where you identify a document and do a before and after measurement of what happens to revenue collection or compliance or whatever the case is for those documents. Those are all the kinds of things certainly within the next biennium we could do without making any kind of resource demands on people. Be able to report back to you the progress, what kinds of things have been done, and then make recommendations at the next session about are there more resources that are needed, do we need mandates for other agencies and those kinds of things. We think that should alleviate concerns about fiscals, but still generate real and meaningful work that comes back to you and gets reported in terms of changes that get made.
Questions? Representative Edwards?
So to clarify, this doesn't kill the process, keeps the conversation going, but essentially slows it down. Is that fair?
Chair Riley, Representative Edwards, I'm not sure slows it down from what either the original bill or we as agencies had in mind in terms of what work would get done. What it does is it takes away the fear of an absolute mandate kicking in on all documents that would be very, very difficult to meet, and I don't think was what anybody really had in mind, as opposed to actually getting agencies to begin to do better work in this area.
And I would agree that was really the intent of the bill, was to get this started and to eventually get everything done. Eventually is a long time, but we would certainly like the best movement we can get without too many additional resources. Representative Duran.
Oh, thank you. Dealing with the amendments, lines 4 through 7, this is where the governor assigns this to a state agency and the responsibility for it, and to come up with a plan, and then how he's going to ensure it, and that sort of thing. I'm having a hard time understanding. I mean, this bill is really what it was originally was. We're supposed to write documents in plain English. It's supposed to be fairly simple. Now, what we're doing is we're throwing it into the red tape of government and trying to, we're going to create an agency, we're going to assign it to an agency, we're going to come up with a plan, we're going to ensure that it's carried out. It's kind of funny because it goes against the crux of the bill.
Chair Alley, Representative Gerard, I think that the concern when agencies get a mandate, you know, you will comply with whatever standards. Although, you know, sometimes it's tempting to say, well, you know, sometimes they just don't really pay attention to that. Agencies really do try really hard to meet these kinds of standards. And again, it's that everything has to meet it as of that date element that became a concern. An example, Department of Human Services has, I think they told me 40,000 web pages that they deliver on the various programs and services that they have and those kinds of things. And forget about going back and dealing with 40,000 web pages. Just think about the ordinary course of business of doing a new web page, updating a web page. The concern that they were dealing with that everything has to comply that's new as of January, was they're doing hundreds, if not thousands, every week, and that was what was driving the fiscal. And so the question became, what can we do short of that mandate? As of this date, everything will be plain. That'll still get progress made, but can clearly be shaped within the resources they have, and that's really what we're trying to do with this.
Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
I don't think he answered the question.
Okay.
The question is, why are we putting all these other little factors in here that the governor's going to assign it to an agency, develop a plan, and ensure all this? I'm trying to understand that. I understand the crux of the bill, and but if people can't write in plain English, maybe they need to be taught to write in plain English. But I think this is before it was a really straightforward bill, and now it's getting more jumbled up than what it's ever been. And I don't like these amendments.
I think I understand, Chair Elliott, Representative Judd. The intent there was, instead of just a trust us, we'll do a plan, it was to build in some actual accountability so that someone would actually have to be put in charge, and reporting would actually have to come back to you so that there'd be some accountability back to the legislative branch about work that was being done. If the committee would be more comfortable with kind of, you know, let us just, you know, go off and do it, I guess that would be your call, but that was what the intent was to make sure that you had some mechanism back to make sure that something along the lines of what you were looking for was happening.
Other questions, Representative Edwards?
Well, it's not a question as much as it is a comment. I don't want to see this concept die. And I want to keep moving this forward. If some planning and forethought before the next legislative session leads to the greatest likelihood that we will get something moved through this building, then I'm supportive of these amendments. My guess in hearing about the pushback and imagining the ways and means process and how it could get picked apart there, that, you know, my fear is that we could lose the concept altogether, and so I'm willing to go along and support these because I don't want this concept to die. I think plain talk is needed in our state communications, and if this is strategically the best way to move forward, then I'm supportive.
Let me follow up on it. Mr. Allen, is it your expectation that if we went forward with the bill that we had, that it would have gotten through Ways and Means?
Mr. Chair, I can't answer.
I put you on the spot.
Yeah, well, I really can't answer that.
Let me withdraw that question. Committee, it's my expectation that if we went forward with this bill the way we put it out, it would have not even had a hearing, frankly, in Ways and Means, it would have been put on the shelf. That's my expectation, and it's what I've been led to believe would be the case after seeing the physical that the departments insisted was there. Even though we didn't think it was there, they did, and they probably had good reason to the way the bill was written.
And, Mr. Chair, that's what I was going to offer was it was, I think I was more inclined to think that there didn't need to be a fiscal until I really dove into what agencies were saying. Mm-hmm. And I do think the fiscal impact based on the original language was something that would be hard to just kind of wave your hands and make go away.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'd like to see that.
You'd like to see the
fiscal?
We didn't actually finish the preparation of the fiscal. Do you have some ballpark of where they were going?
Mr. Chair, I don't. My understanding was you were going to hear the discussion today, that based on the discussion, Legislative Fiscal Office would do a fiscal analysis, and then you'd...
I think we're talking about if it weren't amended.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I can answer that. I believe once the committee scheduled it for work session, we had submitted the -1 amendments to Legislative Fiscal Office, and the fiscal analyst got back to me and indicated that it was looking like it was going to have a significant fiscal impact. And upon that, the committee leadership gave permission to the committee to refer it to Ways and Means. Now, once a bill is moved to the Ways and we took a motion to move the bill to Ways and Means Committee, and when that happens, Legislative Fiscal typically stops processing that fiscal impact until it's referred down to them and it's given to the Ways and Means Committee. And then when the Ways and Means Committee scheduled it, that's when work was going to commence on the bill with the -1 amendment. So they ceased doing that once the committee moved the bill to Ways and Means. So at that point they stopped doing it. But based on their conversations, it was going to have a fiscal at least in the hundreds of thousands.
So, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Has this bill actually technically been referred back from Ways and Means?
They never got it. We just did that this morning. We took care of that this morning. It is now in our committee, in our hands, in its original form.
I can clarify that too. Uh-huh. The rules for the House this session indicate that when a bill is amended in committee, the staff has 7 days from when the bill is moved to drop the bill with the chief clerk. And until that happens, until the bill is dropped with the chief clerk and printed and grossed, it is still in committee. So the motions that we did to reconsider the votes by which we sent the bill out basically erased that action that we took. So when we took the first three motions underneath the script for the reconsideration today, it was as if those votes never took place.
So, yes, Representative Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I tend to agree that without this change, this basically goes to Ways and Means to die. But you never know. I guess my question is, do we need this? I mean, as in the office of streamlining, can you just go ahead and make the decision that you want? You think this is a direction that we should go and start working towards that?
Chair Riley, Representative Byer, I think I alluded at the first hearing to the fact that at the beginning of the year, my office and Department of Administrative Services had, in fact, begun discussing a plan potentially leading to an executive order on plain language, and we could certainly continue doing that. Legislative intent's always helpful.
Thank you.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just comparing the -1s with the -2s, and a lot of things are left out. It seems like they could have been incorporated at least as suggestions in developing a plan. I mean, there's some specifics in here that I think should be, that we should be directing the agencies to include, like directions on, in the -2s it says written document conforms to plain language. In the -1s it talks about paper or electronic it specifically mentions electronic. This one doesn't. Mm-hmm. Each individual department agency shall assign at least one individual to lead the agency's plain language standards initiative. That could be like something that they should plan to do and how they're going to come about that, and then ensuring that any individual assigned under the subsection receives adequate training in plain language standards. I mean, those things I think should be part of the plan, and I don't want to see this bill die. I don't want to see it languish. I think it's a very good concept.
Would you respond to that?
Yeah, I can, Chair Riley, Representative Thatcher. A plan would certainly do that, and so if we were going to work with DEQ and DCBS and employment immediately, a plan would certainly recommend that they identify a lead person. The problem with the bill language is it's all agencies. It's not who are we going to focus on first, and so you're talking about finding 140-odd lead people to be assigned with responsibility for plan language and being trained. It's that all agencies umbrella that starts tripping the fiscal issues. And so if left to a plan, those recommendations from that original language are certainly the kinds of things that would show up in the plan, but would be more tailored to where are we going to focus the effort and where's the best bang for the buck in trying to move forward quickly.
Okay, follow up. So what you're saying, if I understand, is that under the dash twos, there is one state agency that would be putting forth a plan, really, instead of individual agencies. Okay, gotcha. So, and it kind of struck me what you said earlier in your testimony, that this would meet agencies where they are now, which I thought, okay, that's kind of interesting. Do you anticipate that any, question?
Well, before you go ahead, and again, the agency that would do this is one of two, very likely. It's either Department of Administrative Services or the Streamlined Division. So, further question.
And they're both here.
Yeah.
Well, I guess my question, I forgot what my question was. It's come back to me.
Okay.
I have a question.
Okay.
Sorry to keep beating a dead horse here, but the cost can only be a cost if you have people that aren't writing plain English now. And that would seem to me that that's a problem within the agencies themselves, and that needs to be rectified.
Chair Riley, Representative Drott, I might argue two costs. One would be the cost of if you have people who aren't doing it now, how do you get them to be doing it? But the second is, if you impose a requirement that everything going forward has to comply with a new law, the other cost that some of the larger agencies are identifying is, who's going to make sure that's happening? Who's going to look at the document that's being done by this section over here that we think is okay, but we don't know, because they're going to be worried about, are they complying with the law because of the unknowable consequences of what happens if a document goes out that isn't plain? Does that give somebody the ability to raise an issue?
Follow up. There's no penalty clause in this thing. So, if something goes out that's not quite, somebody else can come argue, there's no penalty in here. I mean, are we going to fine the governor if he writes something that's not in plain English? All the document said was put it in plain English.
Chair Riley, Representative Judd, I understand. But again, if it's a mandate, agencies will look at that mandate and say, that's the law. We have to comply with the law. A great parallel example was the old requirement to review rules every 3 years, which is no longer in statute, but was. And I think there were people who were tempted to think, well, agencies aren't really seriously reviewing rules every 3 years. Actually, they honestly were. They were because that mandate was there, and there were mechanisms set up. And in large agencies, there were sometimes complex mechanisms to make sure those rules were being reviewed. When you put a mandate in like that, people will in fact act on the basis of that law. And you can speculate about what would or wouldn't happen, but that's what part of what's driving the fiscal is the concern that someone needs to make sure that they're complying with that law that you would adopt.
Further questions?
I remembered my question.
Okay,
going along the theme that we'd be meeting agencies where they are now with the dash two amendments, did I hear you say that there could be agencies now who could start implementing this right away?
Chair Riley, Representative Thatcher, who could start working on this issue right away? Implement today with, plain language starting immediately. There are agencies that are already doing good work in plain language, others that are already doing developmental work, but we could certainly start working on implementing a plan right away, including developing training, curriculum, standards, those kinds of things.
Representative Edwards. I would accept a motion to adopt the Dash 2 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the House Bill 2702-2 amendment stated March 19th.
Representative Edwards moved to adopt the House Bill 2702-2 amendments dated March 19th. Is there any further discussion?
I vote.
I will. Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Byron?
Aye.
Representative Edwards?
Aye.
Representative Broad?
No.
Representative Fletcher?
Aye.
Chair Riley?
Aye. Having received the required votes, the House Bill amendments, Dash 2 amendments, have been adopted. I'm going to continue this work session until Thursday. I'm going to carry over this work session until our next meeting on Thursday, March 22nd.
I'm just making notes that we'll add it to the agenda after the meeting.
Okay. And so that that is the end of the session of the session for today. I'm going to close the committee on government accountability and information technology, and thank you all very much.